Hello, I'm Lori Watanabe, editor of Mobility Management Magazine, and you're listening to the Mobility Management Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Wheezy Walker, the executive director of NARTS, the National Registry of Rehabilitation Technology Suppliers. And we're going to be talking about NARTS's big anniversary this year, as well as the challenges that rehab technology suppliers are facing today and what the future could look like for RTSs. Wheezy Walker, ATP SMS, is the executive director of NARTS. She has more than 25 years of experience as a CRT supplier, providing seating and mobility for adults and children. Wheezy has served on the NARTS Board of Directors, the Games Board of Directors, and the Professional Standards Board of RESNA. Throughout her career, Wheezy has worked to advocate for professional suppliers and the consumers they serve. She's presented at the Canadian Seating Symposium, RESNA Conference, AOTA Conference, MedTrade, the International Seating Symposium, and the National Seating and Mobility Symposium. Wheezy Walker is a NARTS Simon Margolis Fellow. Wheezy, welcome to our podcast. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Laurie. I'm happy to be here and share all the great news about NARTS.
Well, before we start, I want to just explain a few terms I'll be using. I'll use RTS, Rehabilitation Technology Supplier, to mean the supplier who is the seating and mobility equipment expert on the seating team and the one who is providing the equipment. An RTS who is registered with NARTS is an RRTS, or Registered Rehabilitation Technology Supplier. An RTS who has achieved ATP certification, Assistive Technology Professional, and has held that certification in good standing for at least 3 years, is a CRTS, or a Certified Complex Rehabilitation Technology Supplier. A CRTS also has at least 3 years of continuous employment with a complex rehab technology provider and has been directly involved in consumer service delivery. NARTS now has registrants in all 50 states plus Canada, and you can find more information on application requirements at the NARTS website, which is nrrts.org. Wheezy, first, thanks for being here. Congratulations on the big 30th anniversary. Can you give us a little bit of a taste of how you're celebrating?
Sure, Lori. Each week, we send out a blast from the past, and that goes via email, social media, etc. We're highlighting the various NARTS milestones over the last three decades. And we're also recognizing the people who have served as president of NARTS. The big open meeting on July 27th, we will highlight 30 years, and we're going to present awards to some very deserving people. And I wanted to just note that we picked that week of July because it's the 30th week of our 30th year.
Ah, okay. Now that July 27th meeting, is that going to be a virtual meeting during Zoom with Zoom or something that everybody can dial in and participate in, register?
Yes, unfortunately, it will be a virtual meeting and it will be at 7 p.m. Eastern time. And we'll have a lot more information about how to register for that.
Okay, perfect. And we're all invited?
Absolutely. It's open to any and all, and I hope, you know, everyone will join us. It should be fun. It'll be fun.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we're going to dive into the history a little bit. Mobility management started in 2002, and at that time, complex rehab technology was, of course, just called rehab. So obviously, a lot has changed during NARTS's lifetime, and I've been enjoying the little tweets with, you know, today where NARTS is 13 years old as you kind of go back and celebrate different people. How has the role of the RTS evolved during NARTS's lifetime? Have their responsibilities changed or shifted, and have expectations of RTSs changed over the years?
Well, that's a great question. And I would say the role itself has not changed necessarily, but certainly the knowledge and skill needed has increased significantly because of all the advancement of technology and products available today. And just a side note, I used to tell people when I first started doing seating and mobility back in was right after the wheel was invented, I knew all the products that were available. And today we have a much wider array of products. So suppliers have to have more knowledge to know which of the product options is going to be the best fit for their client. And also, given the internet and everything, the clients, the people that need CRT, have more knowledge as well of what's available. So working together as a team will make a better outcome, but it takes more thought process to know exactly how to make those decisions.
And it takes just ongoing, I guess, awareness, observation, education, right? Because manufacturers come out with new products all the time. That's not an exaggeration to say that in any single week, any given week, you can have multiple manufacturers coming out with new products. And somehow in this jam-packed schedule that they already have, the RTSs need to figure out time to read up or watch videos or schedule a little in-service and read up on those new products. And it's not just that new product, right? It's also how that product can interact with everything else. So if you're talking about new electronics, you have to know, is that programmable? Am I going to be able to use that with all the seating functions? So it's not ever in complex rehab. It is never one component isolated in a vacuum, right? It's all how they work together. And that's a huge amount of information you have to keep up with.
And you bring up a really good point, which is why continuing education is so very, very important. And it's not only just the vast array of products, but it's the techniques that are being used in seating. And the things that we did 30 years ago would probably make us cringe today. And the one that comes to mind is when I first started in the late 70s, it was 90-90-90 positioning.
Right.
And obviously, we've learned a lot. We've come a long way, baby. I'll just say that. Yeah.
So that's a nice transition into the challenges facing today's RTSs. So I wanted to talk about that and ask you what the other members of the seating team, the clinicians, clients, caregivers, funding sources, referral sources, what are they expecting of today's ATP RTS? Because it sounds like these people have to know a lot about a lot of things.
That's correct. So I think of it as that the supplier is having to jump through many hoops to provide the products that their clients need. And we know that some of them are hopefully temporary issues like supply chain and so forth. But the ones that have been with us forever since 30 years ago are coverage issues and payment issues. And then the bigger challenge in that is the supplier being able to explain clearly to the clinician and the client what are these barriers to access. In other words, an insurance company, you could call them and they say, yes, that's covered, but the payment or allowable amount is less than the product cost. So that's a barrier. And being able to explain that clearly is challenging. And the other thing that drives people crazy is the amount of documentation. And I would use the word absurd in many cases. People that have been in a chair, you know, let's say a spinal cord injured person, they're not going to never not need a wheelchair. So why do you have to keep documenting that? So I think that the key would be to have reviewers, the claim reviewers, be people that understood what complex rehab technology is and how it's applied. And in the few states that I'm aware of where that happens, like in the Medicaid program, they have a clinician reviewing it who understands it. It's a much smoother process for everybody. So if I were in charge of the world, that would be the first change I would make, is you have to be knowledgeable of the claim you're reviewing.
I'd love it if you were in charge of the world. Because I remember one of the first things I learned when I started in this industry, and I couldn't believe it. I asked several other people for confirmation. You said that, for instance, someone with a spinal cord injury who uses a wheelchair is never not going to use that wheelchair. And somebody gave me an even more stark example of somebody who has had an amputation. You have to say that person still does not have lower extremities. That amputation is permanent. We all know that. But you still have to say, yes, we're getting a second chair because person still does not have legs to walk with. And so these barriers to access, I would think another thing that seems to me very frustrating for suppliers is, don't the RTSs, CRTSs, RRTSs, don't they get a lot of the blame? I mean, they're the yes. ones saying no, right? They're not saying no because they want to say no. They're the messenger saying no. And doesn't that put them in the line of fire as far as the complaints and the blame?
That's what I'm saying. To be able to explain clearly what the issue is, and you're right, and people think, what do you mean you're not getting paid enough? You know, but obviously suppliers have to have the cost of the equipment covered, you know, and so forth. And it's hard to explain that to somebody because I think we would all agree a lot of it doesn't even make sense at all. And knowing that, you know, this is really the best product for this person, but your insurance doesn't cover it for, you know, whatever reason. And so, again, it goes back to, it should be determined on that individual person's needs, not some algorithm or code, or they have this diagnosis code, so this is the equipment they can get. That's a silly approach to this. And I believe that when the person gets that right match of technology, it does save money in the long run on other healthcare costs. And it certainly improves that person's quality of life. Honestly, it boggles my mind sometimes how many times something has to go back and forth to get coverage for something. I've worked with a young lady for 1 year to get the chair that she needed. 1 year. And it was because her mother and the young lady herself kept fighting for it. A year, you know, and I've heard other stories of people 2 years, 3 years fighting with insurance companies. And I don't understand that. I truly don't.
I also remember at one of the first symposiums I went to, Simon Margolis was saying that if he were a hot dog vendor and I wanted to buy a hot dog, either I would buy the hot dog and pay him on the spot for it, credit card or cash, and he would hand me the hot dog, and that's the end of our transaction. There's no paperwork for the hot dog. I don't have to be qualified for the hot dog. I don't have to have advanced determination to see whether I qualify for the hot dog or if I need to get funding for the hot dog. And everybody would understand that Simon, the hot dog vendor, needed to make enough profit off that hot dog to pay for the hot dog and the bun and the mustard and the hot dog cart and his permit for the hot dog cart. And no one would say, well, no, you should still stay in business. You should sell me the hot dog and lose money with every hot dog you sell. And then you should not expect to get paid for the hot dog until you wait 6 months or whatever. And he said, it's really so easy for people to understand with a lot of other consumer products. But with wheelchairs and seating, all that common sense where everybody would nod along and say, well, of course, the hot dog vendor has to make enough money off that hot dog to pay for all of his expenses. Otherwise, he can't stay in business. That just gets lost on the wheelchair side. I always remember Simon saying that some days he thought that he would be better off being a hot dog vendor.
I've heard that a lot.
We could sell
a lot of those hot dog carts. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So as if things weren't complicated enough, we have the COVID-19 pandemic. I wanted to ask how that pandemic has altered how RTSs have had to do business, what you've learned or heard from RTSs who are doing business in this pandemic.
Yes, I still talk on a regular basis with a lot of my friends that are obviously still working in the field. And what they were telling me, I was interested, you know, first of all, they had to learn how to use the personal protection, right, the properly. And although infection control is always paramount, always has been, this obviously took it to a whole new level. And so they had to learn how to do that and be able to safely deliver products to a client's home. And we realized fitting a chair to a client is pretty, you're in very close proximity to that person. You know, there's no right. social distancing. Right. And so I believe a lot of them put themselves at risk early on during the pandemic, but they knew that these were critical services. People needed to have their mobility, and so that they were willing to go out. It meant that they could see less people each day as they traveled around, and just the added time to prepare themselves, to protect themselves from the virus. We did find a bright spot with the telehealth services. And one of the clinicians that I used to work with was telling me how she really gained a lot of useful information being able to see her client in their home environment. And that was a huge benefit. And so generally, it's only the supplier, you know, that goes out to the person's home. So we'll take the good, because it was a lot of bad going on out there. And I did worry at first, and I think a lot of suppliers probably got the virus, you know, over the last 2.5 years. And it just really tested how we provide services to people in a safe way. So the telehealth, we're looking to see if that can be a permanent thing going forward. But I caution, we want to use it to the best benefit and not when it's not in the best interest of the client. I mean, sometimes that's not going to be the best option for everybody.
Okay, it's a really good point that the protective equipment, the masks and gloves and gowns and shields and all that, that's an extra expense, again, yes. that was not included in the reimbursement pricing for products, obviously, because those reimbursement rates were set long before the pandemic, so it didn't take into account how many gowns and masks and gloves the suppliers had to go through. And at the beginning of the pandemic, we really didn't know, did we, how it was spread. We didn't know if it was spread by touch, remember we were all bleaching our groceries for a while when they got back from the grocery store.
Yeah.
Because we just didn't have the information on how it was most easily spread. So it's not like suppliers were able to say, well, you know, once the CDC figures this out, and once all the scientists have come out, I'll see you in 6 months. I mean, they had to keep going they kept going.
I want to mention too the additional expense of the garb, I'll call it the protective garb, but beyond that is all the price of gasoline, for instance, or shipping charges. And so the providers are absorbing all this additional cost to provide these products, but the reimbursement stays the same. Like we were talking about the hot dog, Congress needs to really look at how they can help providers overcome that. And when you and I go to the grocery store, everything we buy costs more, right? Because
exactly, yes.
And that's not the case for wheelchairs and seating. It is what it is. It's the same amount. Whether you had to drive, you know, 100 miles to deliver it or, you know, around the corner. And I could go on and on about this. And I know you probably have a time limit on this podcast. So, but it does bother me that Yeah, that's not taken into consideration on reimbursement for equipment. The supplier's time, their expertise, all of that, all the effort that goes into it, it's just included in the price of the equipment.
Right. You mentioned that one of the good things about telehealth is that it gave more clinicians, more members of the seating team, sort of a really insider look at what the home environment is of the person using the wheelchair. And that's been really helpful to clinicians to understand, like, okay, how are they doing transfers? Is there enough room to turn this wheelchair around, et cetera? I wanted to bring up what I think has always been probably a really challenging part of the job. It was kind of brought to my attention more during the pandemic, but I wanted to recognize that RTSs see a lot of really troubling things on the job. And sometimes those things come from that home environment, because I think if most people are like me, when I have a doctor's appointment or a dentist appointment, when I have a dentist appointment, I brush my teeth so many times in the 24 hours before I see the dentist, it's insane, right? And they are seeing me basically at my best. When someone comes into the home, though, it's a different story.
Yes.
And RTSs can see a lot of very difficult things. I mean, already they're seeing people who every day who are in pain or who are losing function, and that is distressing, especially if you form close bonds with clients because you've been working with them for years and years and years. To see those people lose function, to see them in pain, to see them eventually pass away in a lot of cases is obviously very difficult. And additionally, going into their homes and perhaps seeing people who are living in neglect, or their homes are being neglected. It's not necessarily a clean, sterile environment that you would see in a clinic, or a cleaner environment, certainly, that you would see in a clinic. And I would think that is emotionally very difficult on top of everything else, on top of all the stress of a tight schedule and having to know all this equipment and getting squeezed on the financial side. That emotionally, this is a tough job. It's always been a tough job, and it's probably now getting tougher. I would think that one of the many benefits of NARTS would be actually that you can offer an emotional and social kind of support net, because maybe people don't feel comfortable telling all of their family members at dinner, especially if there's kids at the table, what you saw, that one of your clients, you went into the home today and pulled back the covers and there was gangrene that you saw that wasn't being treated. Things like that are almost, like, those are common occurrences.
Yes.
for RTSs, right? And yet it's not something you necessarily can talk about with your friends or other family members if they're not in the same industry. So I know it kind of sounds like a small thing, but for example, NARTS hosts a happy hour every Wednesday.
Yeah.
Every Wednesday evening, 6 p.m. Eastern, in case you're interested, throw in a little plug for that. How important is it to offer a way also for RTSs to be able to talk with each other and kind of hold each other up, support each other in a way that maybe other friends and family can't do? How important is that?
Well, you kind of hit the nail on the head, because, and thank you for the happy hour plug. It's always fun. You never know who's going to be on there. And we often start sharing stories. And so you know that the person you're telling understands it or has experienced it themselves. For instance, I did a lot of work with the ALS clinic at Emory. And you develop a relationship with these people. And you might see them on a frequent basis. And I just think that, you know, we have to help each other enjoy those moments that you're giving that person as much mobility and independence and function as possible. And that's your job, and that's what you're there for. And you know, the therapists, the nurses and doctors in those clinics, they're dealing with that as well. And I worked with pediatrics, and there were a couple of times that I had to step out of the room for a minute and kind of regain my composure. But I always wanted to stay focused on what I was there to do. I knew it mattered. I knew it made a difference. It made not only for the person I was working with, but their family. Hopefully it made their life a little bit easier. And this may sound really corny, but it is the truth. It gave me a deep understanding of appreciating each day as it comes. And you don't know, but I'm glad you brought that up, because I hope that for anyone out there that doesn't have someone to share this with, you know, the happy hour is a good way to start. They can contact me or other people that you work with, because it's the reality of any healthcare professional is facing that issue.
We talk a lot, and we're going to talk a little bit more with my next question about the many educational professional opportunities mm-hmm. that NARTS offers, the many benefits of membership professionally. But I just wanted to get a little plug in for the social and emotional support that NARTS can also provide, because I think especially in this time when everybody has been pretty isolated the last 2+ years, that if the only people you have to talk about are family members who are not in the industry, you might be reluctant to share everything you see, because it's not easy and you don't want to necessarily burden them with it. So
that's how happy hour got started, right? Was we miss seeing each other, and you know, we haven't been to a conference. I'm looking forward to the fall. There's a couple of in-person conferences coming up where I can see people. But you're right. When you have that group of people together, somebody's going to say, oh, you know, I saw blah, blah, blah. And the next person goes, oh, yeah, you know, that's a consistent part of being together. And so that's why Happy Hour is still going, 2.5 years later? It's been 2.5 years, right? Since
the
pandemic. Hard to believe.
We also hear that complex rehab professionals are significantly older than the average age of professionals in other industries, which makes finding and raising up the next generation of RTSs a really critical point. So I wanted to ask you about what educational and professional opportunities NARTS membership offers, because obviously, eventually people are going to retire. I wanted to ask about what professional development opportunities an arts membership can offer.
Well, first of all, that's been my concern for a number of years. And so it's such a unique profession. The other day, I was at Shepherd in the seating clinic, and they allow me to go in and take pictures to use for our education, right? And I was explaining to the mother of this young man what we were doing. And I said, the problem is you probably never knew there were people that did seating and mobility as a profession until your son needed this service. And she said, yeah. And I said, so therefore, there are people out there that don't even know this profession exists. It's twofold. One is obviously our webinar series that Michelle Lang puts together, a great webinar lineup of a couple of dozen live webinars every year. About 3 years ago, the NARTS board said, we need a program that takes a person and gives them the basic knowledge and skill that they would need to work with clients in the field. And it's been a labor of love, really. And I have to acknowledge the subject matter experts working with us are Jean Minkle, Susan Taylor, Ann Kieschnick, and Michelle Gunn. And so we're putting together this course that any person can take, and it will take you through everything that you need to know to get started. Jean Minkle said it best. It will teach people to know what they don't know, because being competent as a supplier takes, you need mentoring, you need experience, and it's an ongoing growth, if you will. But there has to be a pathway to draw people into it, right? And there's currently not one. I've had people call me on the phone and, you know, somehow or another they've learned about it and then were like, well, how do you get started? And there's just really not a good answer to that. If a provider's willing to hire you and train you, so be it. But this will give people an understanding of what that role of the supplier is and the anatomy they need to understand. They need to understand pressure management to prevent pressure injury, all of that. So I'm really excited to get this program going and to be able to start offering it soon. And also, if we want to be considered professionals, we need this standardized base of education that everyone would subscribe to.
So that's something that you could point to, right? The industry could point to tell referral sources, to tell payers, this is the certification that we require. This is the education people have gotten, rather than historically, the education from RTS to RTS may have varied a lot, depending on if you're the child of an RTS, right? And you came in through the industry that way, or if you're somebody who came in as a repair technician and kind of worked your way up, or you're somebody who literally just kind of stumbled in the door and they hired you and you learned and you thought, this is what I want to do. I mean, the path to becoming an RTS and a CRTS and an RRTS, those paths of education have varied widely during the history of complex rehab, right? And so having a certificate program, for instance, we would be able to point to that. Obviously, people will come in different doors, but still you would be able to point like, this is one of the paths here. This is what most of our folks are taking, so that there's a commonality, I guess, or a basic foundational commonality of what they know.
Right.
Okay. Last question. What's going to be asked of the next generation of RTSs, and based on what the next generation of RTSs will need to know, what they'll need to do, what are some of NARTS's priorities going forward? Is it mostly about this education and really solidifying that, or do you have other priorities as well?
Well, that is certainly a huge part of it, and probably most people I know are sick of hearing me talk about it, but we're very committed to providing this to the industry. But the other part of that too, Laurie, is to let the people who need this equipment know that you might want to ask the person that's been brought in to provide it, you know, are you a NARTS registrant? We're talking to different funding agencies. And it's not that we would say, oh, well, you need to require the supplier to be a NARTS registrant. That would be good, but our focus really is to share the resources that NARTS offers. And I'll go back to what I was talking about earlier. The person reviewing the claims at the Medicaid programs or private insurance or whatever would give them access to, they could look up stuff if they want to unbiased opinion on something. And our Canadian registrants have really shown us how effective that is, in that within a year, there are almost 300 Canadian registrants across Canada. They have had me talk to groups of clinicians, to their dealer provider organizations, and then the Canadian committee themselves have gone out and they've gotten talked to their competition. We need this. We need to raise the bar. And at the end of the day, it's just like seating and mobility is a team sport. So it's not just a certificate program, but it's letting the consumers know that they can work with an NARTS registrant. And now, I'll point back to when Simon first talked to me about this registry idea he had, it was to give consumers a form of protection. that you would be held accountable if there was something that needed to be changed or improved or fixed or whatever, that you would be held accountable. And I think sadly today, some people are getting services that really aren't meeting their needs, but there was a lady on our CRT Awareness Day last year, and her story just stuck with me, that she had a spinal cord injury, paraplegic, got a wheelchair. She was in pain. She was in discomfort. She couldn't sit for more than a couple hours. Think about that. It affected her whole life. She couldn't participate, go places. She thought it was because of her spinal cord injury. After some period of time, I want to say it was like 3 years, she got a new chair. Guess what? She said, I wasn't in pain anymore. I could be up in my chair 10, 12 hours a day. Should it change my life? Things like that just tells you that, you know, we're on the right track and we need to make this happen. So educating consumers, funding sources, other suppliers, providers, the employers, why this is important. And, you know, that was Simon's idea and rings true today.
And thank you, by the way, personal plug, also for hosting the monthly CRT update webinars, which NARTS hosts along with NCART, the Clinician Task Force, and US Rehab. But I needed to say, I always look forward to your greetings, your welcome at the start of those webinars. And I'm sitting in my home office and I always yell out, "Hi, Wheezy," when you say that. So I'm not kidding. It's gotten me through some really tricky days during this pandemic. So thank you for being with us. We'll wrap up this episode now with Wheezy Walker, the Executive Director of NARTS. Mobility Management podcasts are available for listening and downloading on iTunes, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The best way to make sure you don't miss any episodes is to subscribe. And you can also go to our website to listen to our podcast. The Mobility Management website is mobilitymgmt.com. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll be back again with another episode soon.